It's an absolute delight to be here with all of you today. I regret that other meetings that I wasn't able to get out of truncated my ability to be with you yesterday, and I gather from the conversations I've had outdoors on this beautiful day in California that this has been a very stimulating and exciting gathering with lots of useful and interesting perspectives. And I'm delighted to be able to address you this afternoon and hoping that we can have some vigorous conversation about the topics that I want to put in front of you, because I think they are certainly high on the list of areas where scientists who are Christians need to become involved and stay involved. We are just sort of on the edge, I think, of a whole host of developments spurred on by genetics that are going to require careful and deliberative thought. And those of us who are blessed enough to have a foundation for how we decide what direction to go in, namely our faith, we'll need to be deeply engaged if the outcome is going to be one that Almighty God would be proud of. So that's not to put too much responsibility on all of us, but we do have that responsibility. I thought I'd begin just by reading Psalm 8, because this is the psalm that so much speaks to me in terms of the interface between science and faith, which is much of what I want to talk about with you this afternoon, and much of what you all certainly think about on a regular basis, especially when you come to a meeting such as this. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. From the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise because of your enemies, to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The Son of Man, that you care for him. You made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. I love that psalm because it really does speak from David's heart, rather as a scientist, the glories of the heavens, the amazing features of biology, and yet the real message here, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Well, I have been a member of ASA for almost 20 years, but it's the first time I've been able to come to this annual meeting. And I confess that I am humbled to come before you today to speak about the interface between science and faith, because many of you in this room have written in very eloquent terms about the intricacies of how we synthesize those components of our worldview. My own understanding is still a work in progress, and you may find places that you would like to challenge me, and I hope you will. But this organization has been a constant source of encouragement to me over the course of those nearly 20 years, and I am proud of my membership and hoping to learn more every time I encounter somebody who is part of this. I'm very fond of this particular image, if I can get it to pop up here. This is one that I have shown on various occasions before, and I think it actually is very thought-provoking. You're looking at two different images here, but they look a lot alike. The rose window from York Minster, obviously a beautiful stained glass window. And this is not the usual picture of DNA where you look at it from the side. This is sort of looking down the barrel of DNA so that the double helix in its spiral form is shown in a particularly beautiful aspect. So these are sort of two worldviews which most people out there imagine are incompatible, the scientific view, the spiritual view. For me, having those worldviews synthesized within me is a wonderful opportunity to appreciate each in a special way. And I know I speak for many of you that you have that same experience, and yet many people out there think that's not possible. So I thought it might be appropriate, a little different than the usual scientific talk that I give, to tell you a little bit about my own background, because I know that was part of the intention of the organizers of this meeting in having such plenary presentations. And I think probably we should do this as we talk about personal issues of our belief system. Where did those come from anyway, and how did we arrive at them? Well, in so doing, I don't want to embarrass you. I might embarrass me, but I don't want to embarrass you. But I think I should fill you in a little bit on my own perspective. I grew up in a home in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia where faith was not practiced. My parents were very creative people, particularly in theater and the arts. They taught me at home until the sixth grade, but not because of a desire to instill religious beliefs into me, as is often now the case with homeschooling, but rather instead to keep me out of the hands of the county schools, whose teachers were perceived as being a little less than encouraging to creative instincts of my mother's four boys. And so, in fact, she succeeded quite well, I would say, in inspiring in me a desire to learn things. But I didn't learn a thing about what faith was or what belief in God would be about, because I did not see that modeled. Now, I was sent to church at the age of six, but for a very specific reason. I was sent there to join the boys' choir and to learn music. And I remember a clear little speech from my father saying, "You're there to learn the music. There's going to be this other puzzling stuff about theology. Don't pay any attention to that. It'll just confuse you." So I followed those instructions, and I learned a lot about music, but I had no clue what was going on in terms of the rest of those services. And so when I got to college, and my friends in the dormitory would quiz me about what I believed, because that's one of the things that happens your freshman year in college, I realized I had absolutely no idea what I believed. And it was fairly easy for me to decide I didn't believe any of this stuff that some of the people were talking about Christ or other forms of religious faith. I assumed that was all superstition, and I had gotten along quite well without it so far and didn't feel any particular need to embrace it then. I finished my undergraduate degree in chemistry, went on to a PhD in chemical physics at Yale, and there, after delving into that particular field and concluding that the only thing that was real truth were second-order differential equations. And there seemed to be even less need for God, because God didn't seem to me like he would probably be a second-order differential equation. So I became a rather obnoxious atheist in graduate school. If you had gone to lunch with me, you wouldn't have enjoyed the experience. Maybe I wouldn't have either, because you might have pointed out to me that some of my concepts were pretty wrong-headed. But just the same, I was certainly in a frame of mind that held absolutely no interest in matters of the spiritual life, because I didn't think there was such a thing. But then, as you heard, I changed directions, and deciding that biology was actually a lot more interesting than I had thought it was, decided I would go to medical school and learn that particular discipline and perhaps try to figure out how to apply my scientific instincts in a direction more towards human health. And as a medical student, I encountered many people going through terrible suffering, stricken down with diseases not of their own making. And yet I could not help but note in these places that I encountered these people, often small hospitals in North Carolina, that some of these people seemed to have incredible faith. And they weren't angry at God, which I thought they should have been. I mean, if they believed in a God and he let them get cancer, why aren't they shaking their fist? Instead, they seemed to derive this remarkable sense of comfort from their faith, even at a time of great adversity. And that really puzzled me. And a few of my patients asked me, "Well, what do you believe?" And I stammered and stuttered and realized I was embarrassed to say I didn't know. And something came to me, that as a scientist, I had always insisted upon collecting rigorous data before drawing a conclusion. And yet, in matters of faith, I'd never collected any data at all before rejecting it. I didn't know what I had rejected. So I decided, well, I'd better be a little bit better grounded in my atheism, so I'd better find out what this is all about. And you know what happens next. I went off and challenged a Methodist minister who lived down the street about what all this stuff was, and a very patient man he was. And after listening to my questions and realizing that I was not dealing with a very full deck of information, he suggested that I might try to read the book of John, which I did, and found that interesting and puzzling and not at all what I thought faith was about. But still, I wasn't ready, I think, to consider the plausibility of faith. I needed more of an intellectual basis to get past all of my own arguments about why this was just superstition. And for that purpose, he turned me to the writings of C.S. Lewis. And I suspect many of you had that experience. And even today, now decades after he wrote that book called Mere Christianity, it still, to me, seems to be the very best book to put in the hands of a young seeker who is trying to figure out, is there a plausibility, a rationality for faith, when the message seems to have come across in various settings that there is not. So I read Mere Christianity, and my materialist view was quickly laid to ruins. And particularly compelling for me was Lewis's argument about the law of human nature. Why is it there? Why is it universal? And his argument also that wouldn't this just be the place to look for evidence of a personal God if there was one, and a personal God who is perfect and holy? Now, I know the sociobiologists will argue that that is all in some way an evolutionary consequence. That has never seemed to me particularly compelling as an explanation for the moral law that we know somehow intrinsically and yet oftentimes find that we don't obey. There's a wonderful sentence from Lewis. You find out more about God from the moral law than from the universe in general. Just as you find out more about a man by listening to his conversation than by looking at a house he has built. And I realized my scientific life was looking at the house. And the conversation, the moral law, I'd never really considered as evidence of God. Well, after many months of struggling with this and realizing if there was a God, he was holy and I was not, and realizing perhaps for the first time just how flawed a person I was, and then recognizing what Christ did by providing a bridge between me and all of my unholiness and God and his holiness, finally I gave in and surrendered. Not perhaps like Lewis, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England, which is how he described his conversion evening, but I was certainly not afflicted by a rush of warm emotion either. It was still very much like walking into a complete unknown and not knowing what it was going to do to me or how it would affect me. But God is good. And over the course of many more years of learning, and I'm still on that road, faith has become and is the guiding light of my life. So that's the spiritual part of my worldview. My scientific worldview began earlier, really, because I got excited about science as a high school student. As I've mentioned, I then got excited about chemistry, then went on to medicine, and ultimately got excited about genetics as a way that one might unravel all of these mysteries that have been so difficult to understand about medical illness. But I certainly never imagined that a call would come where I would be asked to move to the National Institutes of Health and become, of all things, a federal employee and direct a project aimed at mapping and sequencing all of the letters of the human instruction book. A truly remarkable moment in history, and a moment that we've essentially now just passed through. It's been 9 years since I came to NIH. It has been an incredible ride, and it ain't over yet. In many ways, we're at the end of the beginning, and where we're going next, I think, will have even more profound impacts on medicine and on what we think about ourselves and on our society. And again, I think as Christians, we bring a special perspective into how to usher in this new revolution in a fashion that has the maximum benefits and is done in the most benevolent way. So let me say a few words about that, sort of as the next part of this presentation. Where exactly are we as far as our understanding of the genome, and where is this going to take us? Well, the Human Genome Project has now been going on for 12 years. By next April of 2003, all of the original goals of this project will have been achieved. And that will be 3 years ahead of the projected deadline of 2005. And I'm happy to say, and it plays very well inside the Beltway, this has all been done for substantially less money than was originally projected. So here we have a federally funded project that's ahead of schedule and under budget. And boy, does that make life easier for me. Now, the applications of the Genome Project are really going to be across the board in virtually every area of medicine, because virtually every disease has some genetic component. People have tended in the past to emphasize those disorders that are inherited in very strong genetic ways, like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease or sickle cell disease. But virtually everything, except I'll maybe accept a few cases of trauma, has some genetic component. Diabetes, heart disease, mental illness, asthma, high blood pressure, cancer, go down that list. All of those tend to run in families, which means there are glitches in the DNA sequence that predispose people to be at risk. And the second point of this slide is that there are no perfect specimens. This is the biological equivalent of original sin. We are all flawed. We have all fallen short. There is no perfect DNA sequence. There's only all of us. And we all have probably dozens of places in our DNA where you wish you had a T, but you really have a C. And that is going to make you at risk for something. Now, many of those you will never be bothered by because you won't encounter the environmental trigger that it would take to cause that one to really emerge as a problem, or you won't have a mix of susceptibilities to push you over a certain threshold. But we've all got stuff in there that's lurking that is probably going to cause us some trouble. And we are on the brink in the next 10 years or so of being able to find out what those are for each one of us. And the enormity of that potential is really seriously to contemplate. So, of course, if one wants to understand all of that, this amazing molecule is the one we have to understand. And now, almost 50 years since Watson and Crick unraveled the structure of the double helix, I think it is still amazing as a biologist to contemplate the elegance of this way of carrying information, this way that is shared by all life forms, this digital code that allows, in a very easily copyable form, such a massive amount of information to be carried around inside each cell of the human body. So if this is the double helix, and if each one of these letters is a base pair, the whole human genome is 3 billion of those. And while that's a huge number, it still seems to me surprising that it's a finite number. I mean, this 3 billion letters has to be able to direct all of the biological properties of a human being. And there are a lot of biological properties of a human being, especially when you consider the complexities of development. And yet this has to be enough. So the Human Genome Project aimed to read out all those letters, but also to develop techniques to enable us to understand what this language was all about, because otherwise it would really be gibberish. We'd have a very hard time understanding what it's telling us. And so I would say part of the success of the project has been reading out the letters, but a major part has been developing other methods to understand what's encoded within them. We reached a significant milestone just about a year ago with the publication in Nature of the longest paper that Nature has ever published, some 62 pages of fine print, describing what we had learned with the first reading of a draft of the human genome sequence. And this was an exhilarating experience. I and about four dozen of my colleagues spent about 6 months doing almost nothing else but trying to figure out what we could learn from reading this. It's like reading the world's most incredible literature classic that no one else had ever read before and getting to write the first sort of critical review. And out of this, I must say, we learned an incredible amount of things that were surprises. By the way, all of this data is available, and that was a cardinal principle of the international consortium that I've had the privilege to lead, that every bit of the information was released onto the Internet every 24 hours. This, I think, history will look back on as having been a rather defining characteristic of the effort, because it enabled anybody with a good idea to begin to work with the information immediately and not wait for some future time or have to put up some large amount of money in order to gain access to the information. Here is one of the browsers. In fact, this is my favorite one, which is written by a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz, which will enable you to go and look at the whole genome and all sorts of features about what's there. You can zoom in down to the base pair. You can zoom out to the chromosome. You can move to the left or the right. You can see what genes are there. You can click on them, and it will tell you what that gene does as best we know it. It will tell you where you're matching to a mouse sequence or a fish sequence. It is a phenomenal tool, and it's all free as long as you've got an Internet connection. Well, there were some pretty surprising things that we discovered in reading out this sequence, and I could go on for a long time about that, and I won't, but I'll just hit about four highlights. One of them was, in fact, the very surprisingly small number of genes that exist in the human genome. Now, my definition of a gene here, because people use different terminology, is a stretch of DNA that codes for a particular protein. There are probably stretches of DNA that code for RNAs that don't go on to make proteins, and that is, in fact, a world that is only just now beginning to emerge and may be fairly complicated. But the standard definition of a gene that codes for a protein gives one a surprisingly small number of about 30,000 for the number of human genes. Considering that we've been talking about 100,000 genes for the last 15 years, and that's what most of the textbooks still say, this was a bit of a shock. In fact, some people took it quite personally. And they were particularly, I think, distressed because the gene count for some other simpler organisms had been previously determined. And after all, a roundworm has 19,000 genes, and the mustard weed has 25,000 genes, and we only have 30,000? Does that seem fair? Even worse, when they decoded the genome of the rice about 2 or 3 months ago, it looks as if rice has about 55,000 genes. So you need to have more respect for dinner tonight. So what is that saying? I mean, surely an alien coming from outer space, looking at a human being and looking at a rice plant, would say the human being is biologically more complex. I don't think there's much doubt about that. So gene count must not be the whole story. So what's going on? Well, one of the things that's going on is that we have certainly begun to realize that one gene does not just make one protein in humans and other mammals. On the average, you make about three using this phenomenon of alternative splicing. And the proteins have interesting architecture, and I'm not going to go into that, but one is beginning to recover some sense of pride here in our genome, which was briefly under attack, because now we can say, well, yeah, we don't have very many genes, but boy, are they clever genes. Look what they can do. We also discovered that simply by looking at the Y chromosome and comparing it to the rest of the genome, and of course the Y chromosome only passes from fathers to sons, so it only travels through males, you can get a fix on the mutation rate in males compared to females. And this was not particularly good news for the boys in this project, because it seems that we make mistakes about twice as often as the women do in passing our DNA on to the next generation. Yeah, exactly. Sarah is asking, why is that surprising? Huh? Right, I think a wealth of experience could have predicted this. So that means, guys, that we have to take responsibility for the majority of genetic disease. It has to start somewhere, and the majority of the time it starts in us. But if you're feeling depressed about that, let me also point out that that means we can take credit for the majority of evolutionary progress, which is, after all, the same phenomenon. Well, another thing which I think was actually quite gratifying, I've been troubled for a long time about the way in which we dismissed about 95% of the genome as being junk because we didn't know what its function was and we didn't think it had one because we hadn't discovered one yet. But when you have the whole genome in front of you, it's pretty clear that a lot of the stuff we call junk has the fingerprints of being a DNA sequence that's actually doing something, at least judging by the way evolution has treated it. So I think we should probably remove the term junk from the genome. At least most of it looks as if it may very well have some kind of function. Well, where do we go from this? As I said, we're almost done with this. By the way, we're at a very advanced draft stage. By next April, which conveniently happens to be the 50th anniversary of Watson and Crick's paper, we will have the whole human genome sequence finished. It will be done for all time. Talk about a milestone. There's going to be a lot of fuss made about that, and I think, well, there should be. The draft was interesting, but having the final sequence is, of course, the real point of the whole exercise. But we've already, for several years, been thinking about where to go next with this. And so this particular slide represents only four areas that are already underway and are going to expand considerably as we move into this next phase of genome research, which will be much more now focused towards the medical applications and trying to make those happen. I don't have time to go into each of these areas, but proteomics is certainly a buzzword that many of us are attached to because this is the idea of studying proteins on a global scale instead of one at a time, just as we have been doing so successfully now for DNA and RNA, which is what genomics has been about. Functional genomics, here exemplified by a DNA microarray or a DNA chip, is going to give us the ability to understand how genes turn on or off and what the pathways and networks are that regulate gene expression. Let me say a little bit of a word about comparative genomics because it is both scientifically fascinating and it feeds interesting information into the always contentious discussions about evolution and faith. We have, in fact, not only sequenced the human genome, we also have sequenced a number of other organisms, and a lot more are coming along very quickly. So, for instance, we now have a very advanced draft of the sequence of the laboratory mouse, the organism that is most extensively used by researchers in trying to understand human disease. Now, evolution tells us that human and mouse diverged about 80 million years ago. And yet, when you line up their sequences of the same homologous gene, you see very interesting evidences of similarity. This is a bit of a complicated slide. What's down here at the bottom is showing you a schematic of where you are. You're on chromosome 7. This, by the way, is the gene for cystic fibrosis. But now we're a little bit, maybe 500 kilobases away from that in a gene called CAPZA2, and this is just chosen at random. Almost any of the genes that I analyzed would look this same way. What you're looking at across the top is a schematic of part of that CAPZ-A2 gene in the human. Now, each one of those funny-looking boxes is one of these repetitive sequences. You need not concern yourself much about those. They're just different kinds of transposable elements and other types of repeats. Now, underneath there, what we're plotting is in the mouse homolog of this same region, how close is the sequence of the mouse to the human? And the scale goes from 50% to 100%. We're not bothering with things that are less conserved than that. And so basically, this program allows you to look across and find a stretch where there is identity or close to identity over a stretch of, say, 100 base pairs or so. And I think what you can see, but I'll help you see it, is that each place there is an exon that is a protein encoding region of this gene. This is exon 2, exon 3, exon 4. All three of those are coding for protein. There is a little blip there in the analysis that says the mouse region right there is strongly similar. Whereas in the introns that lie in between protein coding regions, there is less going on, although there's this interesting cloud of similarity here that suggests there may be some other functional elements there that might be doing something important that we haven't discovered yet. Certainly, this kind of evidence, which is in great proliferation, is strongly in support of the evolutionary theory. And I'll come back to that in a bit. Now, in fact, it's not just a human-mouse comparison one can do. Eric Green at the Genome Institute has looked at this same region now in all of these species. And in fact, you can find this same CAPZ-A2 gene in everything from chimps down to zebra fishes and a lot of things in between. And when you line them up, again, it depends a lot how close you are to human, what the pattern is. So the chimpanzee is almost 100% identical to the human, except actually the chimp has a deletion right there that we don't. But where it's not deleted, the matchup, as in most cases of human and chimp comparisons, is about 98.5% to 99%. Baboon, you can see, is starting to shift downward. The cat and the dog and the cow all look a lot alike. And again, if I point out to you where those exons are, you will see that every one of these species has a nice conserved little horizontal bar there that goes along with the protein encoding regions. But as you get further away to rats, the mouse I already showed you, chickens, these are two different kinds of puffer fish, and then a zebra fish, which you can go and buy in the pet store, about the only thing you see there now conserved are the protein encoding regions. The rest of the scattered noise goes away. Again, a very compelling kind of pattern in terms of what one would expect from evolution. Now, I might say that if you look in these regions where there is not a close similarity, and I don't have a diagram to show you this, but this is an important recent discovery. Say you compare the human and the mouse in here or in here, and you allow yourself to look at areas that are less than 50% matched up, but they're still above the statistical noise. One can, in fact, identify lots of examples of transposable elements that are in the same place in the human and in the mouse. And yet they have very dramatically diverged over those 80 million years because presumably they are under no selective pressure whatsoever. They're diverging in a neutral way. And basically every time you see one of those in one species, you see them in the same place in the other. And it is very hard to see how that is not a very strong bit of evidence for a common ancestor for humans and mice. And in fact, when you look at even further distances, you can find those as well. Although the further you go out, the harder it is to be sure you're not looking at noise. So I think one could say, in fact, that we do have these fossils within our genome, transposable elements that landed there hundreds of millions of years ago in some instances, certainly tens of millions of years ago. Their footprints are still there. You can see that they're shared with other species when you go and look in the same location. And again, this does seem to be a very compelling argument. It's hard to think that this could be on the basis of something other than an evolutionary explanation. Well, let me say a thing or two about medical genomics, because I think that's really where the point of this was. And I'm going to make a prediction that based on the trajectory we're on here and our ability to not only understand the genome, but the variations in the genome, the places where we're each different, that we should be able to uncover the major contributing genes for common diseases in the next 5 to 7 years. We've done really well finding the genes for diseases that are strongly inherited, but we haven't done so well so far for these conditions, and that's all about to change with the tools that the Genome Project has produced. And that, in turn, will mean that the clinical implications will begin to kick in, because we will move each disease from the top of this diagram to the bottom over the course of the next 10 or 15 years. We will find the genes that are involved in susceptibility. Those will, in turn, give us the ability to make predictions who's at risk. And if you have a preventive medicine strategy to offer somebody at risk, they're probably... Intervention is colonoscopy, but we can't recommend that for everybody, so we'd like to know who to recommend it for, those who have the highest risk, and DNA testing in many instances is now available for that. Pharmacogenomics, another consequence of this, is the ability to make a prediction about whether this is the right drug for you before you take it, or whether you're the one in 100 people for whom that drug is going to give a terrible side effect. Much of that variability in drug response is going to turn out to be DNA encoded, and we're going to figure out how that works. So don't be surprised if you go to a physician in 5 years and before they write the prescription, might ask for a blood sample and to do a little DNA test. And of course, ultimately, the goal of all this is to develop therapies that are much more effective with fewer side effects than the often empirically derived therapies that we now depend on. And I think while gene therapy has gone through a pretty bumpy road over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, it is in the last couple of years looking promising in at least a couple of conditions. Namely immune deficiencies and hemophilia. My own view, though, is that this pathway, where the gene is used to understand at the most molecular level the basic biological defect, and then you use that to develop a designer drug, is probably going to be the place where the greatest impact of this whole process occurs. And one can already see that happening in a few instances, particularly for cancer, the most dramatic of which is this drug Gleevec, that was recently approved by the FDA for leukemia, which is based exactly on this pathway and has produced a drug which puts almost all patients in remission with very few side effects at all. So that all sounds great. And where is it going to take us? Let me guess at that. So if this all happens the way it's supposed to, by 2010, I think we will have an opportunity to individualize preventive medicine based on DNA-based predictions of what you're at risk for. And if you could do that for perhaps a dozen conditions, which I think will be feasible in 2010, and if you have interventions available to reduce the risk, that should be a really good thing. That'll allow us to focus more of our energies on keeping people healthy instead of spending lots of money after people are already at death's door in the ICU, which seems to be largely what our medical care system is focused on at the moment. Pharmacogenomics should be able to come into the fore here and make sure that the drug is chosen appropriately for that patient with a reduction in adverse outcomes. But there are going to be some issues. What about access? Who's going to have access to this kind of new technology? Our current medical care system seems to turn a blind eye to those who don't have access, and I see no evidence at the moment that that's changing. And so will we be happy with an outcome where only those with financial resources and PhDs have the ability to gain access to the new treatments? That should make all of us troubled. Will we solve this very vexing problem of genetic discrimination? Maybe you'll find out you're at risk for colon cancer, and so you're the one that ought to have colonoscopy every year starting at age 45. But suppose your health insurance agent says, well, gosh, you don't sound like a good risk anymore. I'm sorry, your policy has been canceled. That is happening right now. We need effective federal legislation to prevent that. There is major movement in that regard in the Senate, a little bit less in the House. The President of the United States has made public statements about the need for such legislation. This might be the year where it gets done. But the longer we go on without that, the more trouble we're going to be in. Well, let's go another 10 years. Here, I think, if you remember my diagram, therapy comes at the end of that pathway, but I think by 2020, the therapeutic consequences of this revolution are going to be really in full swing. We'll have designer drugs available for diabetes, for Alzheimer's, for Parkinson's, for high blood pressure, you name it, because all of those pathways will have been traveled down, and those will find their way into the standard care of medicine by 2020, as will gene therapy for some conditions, but I couldn't tell you right now which ones will turn out to be the most attractive for that alternative approach. You will probably just get your genome sequenced. Don't just sample it here and there, looking at this base pair or that base pair. Just do the whole thing. Get it on a CD-ROM, put it in your medical care record, make sure nobody looks at it who isn't authorized to do so, And then it can be incorporated into decision-making, whether it's for choosing whether it's the right drug for you or what kind of preventive medicine strategy you should follow or whatever. But there will be intense debates about some of the ethical questions. What about the non-medical uses of genetics? There was a paper in last Friday's Science, where a group in New Zealand identified a variant in a gene on the X chromosome that they claim plays a major role in whether boys who are subjected to childhood abuse end up growing up to be criminals. It's a very compelling bit of epidemiology. In their particular study, they said 44% of the criminals in New Zealand in their study, the 44% of those who ended up in criminal activities were those who had been subjected to childhood abuse and had this particular variant in the monoamine oxidase gene, a much higher risk than either abuse alone or the gene alone. But you put the two together and the risk would weigh up. Now, can you imagine how that's going to get folded into our criminal justice system? Think about that. Will that be a defense against criminal activity? My genes made me do it, plus I had a bad childhood, so I'm not responsible. Or will it get used in a way to try to deny opportunities for those who have that high-risk version of monoamine oxidase because, you know, they might behave badly later on? Serious issues lurking in the future and not the very distant future. All of which says that a faith perspective is going to be needed more than ever. And in fact, the bioethicists who debate these issues are all smart people, but many of them are really not standing upon a foundation that has a real sense of what's right and wrong. And we as Christians are blessed. It's an incredible blessing to have that rock upon which one can stand when you're trying to make a judgment about a complicated ethical issue. And certainly, while that particular rock makes some of our colleagues nervous, it should, from our perspective, put us in a special position to be able to contribute to those debates in a highly meaningful way. Well, that's sort of where I think we're headed in the next 10 or 20 years. I now want to briefly turn, though, to a question that I've touched on a couple of times, which is this interface between science and faith. And how are we, as ASA members, as scientists who have a strong personal faith, how do we put those two things together? And I'll just give you a bit of a personal view. Because, after all, genetics is perceived as perhaps the area of science that's least compatible with faith. At least it's portrayed that way in what I regret is a very polarized current circumstance between those who look at science of the genome as a particularly evil way of neglecting God's providence, and those, on the other hand, in the scientific community, who by studying genetics seem to have decided that there is no more need for God because they've discovered everything there is to discover. Is there some kind of irreconcilable conflict here? Well, many of our colleagues perceive that. But I don't have to tell you all. That doesn't make sense. Science explores the natural world. Faith explores the supernatural. So we're back to this again. If I want to study this, I'm going to use science. If I want to understand that, then that's where the faith world comes in, the spiritual world. Does that make them separate and impossible to integrate into one person, one experience, one thought? Is Stephen Jay Gould right when he calls these the non-overlapping magisteria? Not from my perspective. These two worldviews coexist in me right now as I'm speaking to you, and I suspect coexist in many of you. And I think we're not torn apart by that. We're not forced into contradictions. In fact, I think we're enriched and blessed. We have an opportunity to practice science as a form of worship. We have a chance to see God as the greatest scientist, and as we discover things about the world, to appreciate the wonders of his creation, perhaps for the first time. And what a gift that is, to be a scientist enabled to do that. Well, so why is the conflict then perceived to be so severe? Science and Christianity do not have a pretty history. That's already been discussed at this meeting a bit. And certainly conflicts tend to arise when science tries to comment upon the supernatural, usually to say it doesn't exist, or when Christians attempt to read the Bible as a science textbook. I'm very fond in having those conversations with the sort of more young earth sect of Christianity to go back to Augustine. Now, here is Augustine, 400 AD. Had no reason to be apologetic because Darwin hadn't come along, right? Augustine was blessed with the ability to look at Genesis 1 without having to fit it into some sort of scientific discovery of the day. And yet, if you read Augustine's interpretation of Genesis 1, it's an awful lot like mine and like many of yours. In fact, Augustine also makes the point how dangerous it is for us to take the Bible and try to turn it into a science text. Here's a wonderful quote from The Literal Meaning of Genesis by Augustine, Book 1, Chapter 19. "It is a disgraceful and dangerous thing for an unbeliever to hear a Christian, while presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scripture, talking nonsense. We should take all means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show up vast ignorance in a Christian and laugh it to scorn. If they find a Christian mistaken in a field which they themselves know well, and hear him maintain his foolish opinions about the Scriptures, how then are they going to believe those Scriptures in matters concerning the resurrection of the dead, the hope of eternal life, and the kingdom of heaven?" Very strong and effective words. And certainly, I must say, from my perspective, this has not been a good 100 years in terms of the polarization between the more evangelical wing of the church and the scientific community. And we seemed to be engaged in an intensely contentious, destructive, and wholly unnecessary debate about evolution and creation. Let me say that from my perspective as a scientist working on the genome, the evidence in favor of evolution is overwhelming. I don't know how many of you saw this issue of U.S. News and World Report last week, The New Reality of Evolution. The church does not come off well in this. Science comes across great, all these new discoveries. The church is portrayed as having sort of tried to hold this back, denying the reality of recent discoveries. It is a disturbing representation. But again, a representation that adequately depicts this polarized circumstance. So what are the arguments in favor of evolution? I know many of you here are experts on this, perhaps even greater than I, but let me quickly say there are two. The fossil record. Now here, microevolution is generally accepted, but macroevolution has growing and compelling evidence. Elephants, turtles, whales, birds, often being cited as groups where transitional species have not been identified. That is no longer true. We've gained more in the fossil record in the last 10 years than in almost the entire previous history of the science. But from my perspective, the area that I know more about, the DNA evidence, the evidence for evolution is profoundly compelling and growing more so every day. I mentioned the ancient repeats that we share, but with mice, in the same location, showing no conceivable evidence of function, diverging at a constant rate, just as predicted by neutral evolution. One could only conclude that this is compelling evidence of a common ancestor, or else that God has placed these functionless DNA fossils in the genome of all living organisms in order to test our faith. I don't find that second alternative very credible. After all, God is the greatest scientist. Would he play this kind of game? That doesn't seem right. Arguments against macroevolution, based on so-called gaps in the fossil records, I think are also profoundly weakened by the much more detailed and digital information revealed from the study of genomes. So outside of a time machine, Darwin could hardly have imagined a more powerful data set than DNA to confirm his theory. So what are the objections then, if I'm saying that this is so easy that we should have just put it all together? Well, obviously, the major objection in many Christians' minds is it's not consistent with Genesis 1. And I find Genesis 1 powerful, but admittedly complex, and at times difficult to understand the two different views, it seems, of the creation of humans. The problem, of course, that a literal interpretation of Genesis 1 carries with it is that it brings one into direct conflict with virtually the fundamental aspects of geology, cosmology, and biology. As recently pointed out by a professor who I've never met, but who has a book which I hope will be coming out soon, Daryl Falk, one should not take the view that young Earth creationism is simply tinkering around the edges of science. If its tenets were true, basically all of the sciences of geology, cosmology, and biology would utterly collapse. It would be the same as saying 2 + 2 = 5, and what that would do to mathematics. So the tragedy, it seems to me, of young Earth creationism is that it takes a relatively recent and extreme view of Genesis 1, applies to it an unjustified scientific gloss, and then asks sincere and well-meaning seekers to swallow this whole, despite the massive discordance with decades of scientific evidence from multiple disciplines. Is it then any wonder that many sadly turn away from faith, concluding that they can't believe in a God who asks for an abandonment of logic and reason. This seems so compelling, and yet I gave a presentation a month ago at the Christian Medical and Dental Association, where surely I thought that I would encounter like-minded people, and several people got up and walked out at the suggestion that young earth creationism ought to be reconsidered as a framework for interpreting Genesis 1. Again, from Augustine, quote, "In matters that are so obscure and far beyond our vision, we find in Holy Scripture passages which can be interpreted in very different ways, without prejudice to the faith we have received. In such cases, we should not rush in headlong and so firmly take our stand on one side that if further progress in the search for truth justly undermines our position, we too fall with it." Again, written 1,600 years ago, right on point. What about intelligent design? Now, here is an area where I think probably some of you in the audience will disagree. I gather you disagreed yesterday. Of course, this argument about irreducible complexity is an interesting one. And yet, I must say, the more one looks at these supposedly complex and irreducibly complex structures, whether it's the flagella, the eye, or the clotting cascade, the more one begins to see some evidence of intermediate forms that could have indeed have some selective advantage. That's far from proven, but there's certainly a suggestion of that in several of those areas. While not offering strong evidence against intelligent design, the study of genomes offers absolutely no support either. In fact, I would say, and many others have said it better, a major problem with intelligent design theory is its lack of a plan for experimental verification. I view ID as an intriguing set of proposals, but I certainly don't view it as the threat to evolution that its most vocal proponents imply. And again, let's be careful of the God of the gaps that Augustine was referring to, where too strong an advocacy for a theory that may ultimately be disproved risks shaking the faith of those who are asked to equate their belief in God with their belief in the theory. We shouldn't ask people to do that. Well, another argument, and here's one where I'm very puzzled about what the answer will turn out to be, is the origin of life. This area, frankly, is, in my view, disarray. 4 billion years ago, the conditions on this planet were completely inhospitable to life as we know it. 3.85 billion years ago, life was teeming. That's a very short period, 150 million years, for the assembly of macromolecules into a self-replicating form. And even the most, bold and optimistic proposals for this fall well short of achieving anything like probability for that kind of event having occurred. So I don't know what that means. Is this where God entered? Is this how life got started? I'm happy to accept that model, but it won't shake my faith if somebody comes up with a model that explains how that could have happened without divine intervention. Again, watch out for the God of the gaps. But I think it is noteworthy that particular area of evolution, namely step one, is still very much in disarray. Well then, so what kind of synthesis is available here? Oh, I went through those already, I'm sorry. You heard that. How do we put these worldviews together? Well, as you will hear, my synthesis of this, which I arrived at before I knew of the ASA, and before I read some of the wonderful articles in its journal that put this particular view forward, which we now refer to generally as theistic evolution. This was my synthesis, and it still is. God, who is not limited in space or time, who created the universe, chose the remarkable mechanism of evolution to create plants and animals of all sorts. By the way, notice in Genesis 1 how plants appear before animals and fish before birds, which is precisely what science tells us, but never mind. Most importantly, God chose this means in full knowledge that it would ultimately give rise to creatures with whom he could have fellowship and relationship, whom he would imbue with the moral law and a longing to seek him, and whom he would ultimately reach out to by himself becoming flesh and walking amongst us. Furthermore, as God is God and not limited by natural laws, he on occasion has performed miracles, which science is unable to judge since they fall outside the natural realm. Those miracles include many signs and wonders in Old Testament days, but most importantly to my Christian faith, the literal and historical resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, which is the absolute cornerstone of what I believe. I find that synthesis completely satisfying. It brings together what I know about Christ from reading about him, from my prayer life, and what I know as a scientist about the natural world. And evolution is not, for me, a stumbling block in any way, so long as one reads Genesis as Augustine did and doesn't insist upon a certain literality for that part of the Bible, which we, in general, don't apply to many other parts. Well, let me finish with a quick glimpse of where we're going in the future. What's over the horizon here as we contemplate our own instruction book and dream of what we might be able to do with that to alleviate suffering, to better the lot of humankind, and hopefully not do things along the way that are damaging to people? Well, there are a number of ethical issues that are raised by this. Some of those are pointed out here in this cartoon of the scientists tripping over Pandora's box. What have we unleashed here? And in fact, the Genome Project has been wonderful grist for cartoons. They seem to suggest that this is what we're really about. I don't think that's where we're going. Or another version of the same theme here. If he gets out of hand, I'll just ask him to climb back in his test tube. So, in fact, it does seem from cartoons such as this that there's a general mix going on there about what this is really all about. And I guess one of the messages that seems to me this raises is one that comes from Proverbs 19, chapter 2, verse 2. It is not good to have zeal without knowledge. There are a lot of people out there getting pretty worked up about genetics and the dangers of it who are sort of going down the wrong path and worrying about the wrong things. And we scientists, I think, have a great obligation to be in there explaining ourselves and what our science is about and what it's capable of and what it isn't. The time for a geneticist, or in fact any scientist, to go into the lab and close the door and let somebody else worry about the consequences of all this has passed. So there are serious ethical issues raised by advances in genomics. I've touched on a couple of them previously. Genetic discrimination, this is one that could be solved with effective policy implementation. Unequal access. What about genetics and race? We are learning that we are 99.9% identical at the DNA level and that most of our differences are differences that pre-existed in the founder population from which we're all descended. And so the notion that you can draw a precise boundary around any particular group and say they're different is not supported by science. And that ought to be a very strong argument in the always contentious debates about genetics and race to try to diminish the opportunity for prejudice. And yet I'm not sure that it will always play out that way. A major question: where are we going to draw the boundaries between treating terrible diseases and enhancing character traits of the next generation? You've probably all seen designer baby scenarios presented on prime time or in the Hollywood version of the movie Gattaca or in a number of other presentations. Most of those aren't very realistic, but they certainly cause pause in terms of trying to figure out whether there ought to be some boundaries placed. The reason they're not very realistic is that most of the characteristics that are portrayed in those scenarios as being enhanced, whether it's intelligence or athletic ability or physical attractiveness, whatever that is, or musical talent, are things which are heavily influenced by the environment, where genetics may skew the odds a little bit, but are certainly not going to determine the outcome. And so the well-heeled couple that decides to spend tens of thousands of dollars taking advantage of an embryo selection program in order to have a son who's going to play first violin in the orchestra and score touchdowns on the football team and get A-plus in math is likely to find that a rather disappointing outcome when their 16-year-old is up in his room listening to heavy metal music and smoking pot. They're going to wonder, what happened here? Because, you know, they forgot that environment was important, too. So that may be our saving grace, that many of those scenarios aren't stopped because of ethical concerns. They're stopped because they don't work. And that would be okay, too. So we really do have to watch out, though, for genetic determinism. I recently saw an article in the religious literature about whether spirituality might be in your genes. And the people who go to church are those who are somehow hardwired to seek after God, and those who don't. I don't think so. That's not supported by the data. Cartoons here as well seem to imply that geneticists... Yeah, right, the serpents really got it wrong here, but well. And I guess all of us, and I'm talking here particularly to myself, I need to be careful that we don't contribute to this deterministic view, to this impression that DNA is all there is, by some of our metaphors. I'm fond, for instance, of referring, or I used to be, to the genome as the book of life. And I saw this cartoon, and I thought, you know, there's a point here. There's a real book of life, and it's not DNA. So we'll call it the instruction book, but I don't think we'll go further than that. So I guess what I'm trying to tell you is, I think we have many dilemmas lying just ahead, and scientists who are Christians have a critical role to play in this genomic revolution, both as scientists and as contributors to those ethical discussions. And I hope the ASA and other organizations like it will step up to that challenge. I guess in that regard, I'd like to read you another quotation, which is written about 100 years ago. This is from the Princeton conservative theologian Benjamin Warfield. It is a wonderful exhortation to Christians. It could well be the motto of ASA. We must not then, as Christians, assume an attitude of antagonism toward the truths of reason, or to the truths of philosophy, or the truths of science, or the truths of history, or the truths of criticism. As children of the light, we must be careful to keep ourselves open to every ray of light. Let us then cultivate an attitude of courage as over against the investigations of the day. None should be more zealous in them than we. None should be more quick to discern truth in every field, more hospitable to receive it, more loyal to follow it, whithersoever it leads. It is not for Christians to be lukewarm in regard to the investigations and discoveries of the time. Rather, as followers of the truth, indeed can have no safety in science or in philosophy, save in the arms of truth. It is for us, therefore, as Christians, to push investigation to the utmost, to be leaders in every science, to stand in the van of criticism, to be the first to catch in every field the voice of the revealer of truth, who is also our Redeemer. All truth belongs to us as followers of Christ, the truth. Let us at length enter into our inheritance. Isn't that a wonderful exhortation? Well, again, I think we are, as scientists who are also believers, the most fortunate. We have the opportunity to explore the natural world at a time in history where mysteries are being revealed almost on a daily basis. And we have the opportunity to perceive the unraveling of those mysteries from a special perspective that is an uncovering of God's grandeur. And this really does seem, in many ways, to be a particularly wonderful form of worship to me. I have two final quotes for you. One is from 100 years ago, a little more, from Richard Ross, the investigator who discovered the life cycle of the malaria parasite. He toiled for many years trying to figure out how it is that this organism gets to humans. And one day, finally, under the microscope, uncovered the parasite in the stomach of a mosquito and knew that he had figured out the missing step. And that day, he wrote this poem. This day, relenting God, hath placed within my hand a wondrous thing, and God be praised. At his command, seeking his secret deeds with tears and toiling breath, I find thy cunning seeds, O million murdering death. Isn't that a powerful 8 lines reflecting this remarkable experience of uncovering something that God has placed in Ronald Ross's hand? And then if this same message was spoken several hundred years earlier by Copernicus, who I know you heard about extensively last night, and sitting next to Owen at lunch, I became aware that I need to track down the source of this quote to be sure that it's not apocryphal. But, because if he didn't know it, I'm in trouble, right? But until proven otherwise, I will accept that this really was written by Copernicus at some point. And I sure hope so, because it says it so well. And it really is a message that I think we can all embrace about the wonderful opportunity we have as scientists and the responsibility to investigate the truth. To know the mighty works of God, to comprehend his wisdom and majesty and power, to appreciate in degree the wonderful working of his laws. Surely all this must be a pleasing and acceptable mode of worship to the Most High, to whom ignorance cannot be more grateful than knowledge. How well said. Thank you all very much.